Remember the pictures of the Sendai Airport in Japan underwater after last month's earthquake and tsunami? Well, this week, the airport reopens to commercial flights. The speedy repair is due in part to the U.S. military. A recent film tells the complicated story of the U.S. military presence in Japan. In 1951, as the Allied occupation of Japan was ending, the U.S. and Japan signed a treaty known as Anpo in Japanese. It allowed the U.S. to keep many military bases in Japan. The title of the film is Anpo. Linda Hoagland is its director. And Linda, tell us more about this treaty and what was happening in 1951.
Well, of course, by then the Korean War had begun, and the United States was very keenly aware of how precious their U.S. bases that had been stationed there during the occupation from 1945 to 51 were to them. And this treaty permitted the United States, at that time there were 250,000 U.S. troops throughout Japan, but it permitted the U.S. to keep those troops and those bases in Japan.
And how many are there now?
My understanding is that there are around 50,000, well over half of them stationed on the tiny island of Okinawa. That's the most contentious location of the U.S. military bases today.
Right. Well, your film tells the story of the protests in Japan against Anpo and how Anpo was captured by some of Japan's leading artists. You show some of that art in the film, and we also have some of it on our website at hereandnow.org. But much of the artwork suggests that the relationship between the United States and Japan is one of, an American giant and a submissive Japan. How would you describe it?
I would be hard put to describe it as an equal relationship. I was born and raised in Japan. My parents were missionaries in rural Japan. They sent us to Japanese public schools where I learned about, for instance, World War II from the Japanese point of view. I guess part of the film is, in a sense, an outgrowth of my acute, childish understanding that I was somehow privileged and completely safe. And it was not something that I understood at the time, but of course the presence of the largely invisible presence of so many U.S. troops in Japan very much contributed to that.
And so you didn't know this history?
I knew nothing of it. The only inkling that I ever got of it was after I became an adult and I started to use my fluent Japanese to subtitle Japanese films. I started subtitling and watching many classic films, and it became apparent to me that something deeply traumatic had happened to the national psyche in 1960, because it was reflected in so many films that were made in 1960. The mood of all these filmmakers' films significantly darkened. And that's when I began researching, and I discovered that there had been essentially a national democratic uprising, much like the one we recently saw in the streets of Cairo, that unfolded in May and June of 1960.
Why do you think it culminated then?
The Anpo that was signed in 1951 was referred to actually by U.S. congressmen as the most unequal treaty the United States has ever signed with anybody. And it was the inherent inequality of this that brought it up for review and amendment and then extension. And so it was around the renewal and the extension of the treaty that the protests erupted. The treaty was so contentious that the entire opposition parties, all the opposition parties, staged a sit-in. And then the prime minister, Kishi, called in the police to arrest all the members of the opposition. This was broadcast on television. And that's when there had been muted demonstrations up to that point. But when all the Japanese public saw a prime minister could just bring in the police to arrest every member of the opposition party, that they became terrified that it was going to go back to fascist conditions that many of them had lived through during World War II, and this they felt they must stop.
You said, you didn't know about this dramatic part of Japan's history. Do you think that most Japanese know about it or no?
Most Japanese young people have no idea, because it is not taught in the school system. It's not part of the educational curriculum. Part of what happened is that, as you'll see in my film, the government saw this incredible energy in the streets, and they decided that they needed to harness this energy. And that's, in fact, what fueled what we knew once as Japan's economic miracle. Of course, that has sadly come to an end. But partly because all that energy was redirected contributed into the economic miracle, this resistance and these protests, including much of the art, became something that was almost taboo because it reflected a very different national psyche, one that was not obedient, but that was charged with resistance and a popular will to help determine democratically their futures.
Can you tell us also about the painter that you call Japan's Picasso, Hiroshi Nakamura?
Yes. I knew nothing about his work. He's a really masterful painter. Japanese national television called NHK has a weekly Sunday morning program called the Sunday Museum. And I saw one of his paintings on this program, and I raced to the museum that was holding a retrospective of his work, and I was completely startled because I think if you look at any of the oil paintings that hopefully are on your website, you'll see that his work represents something closer to Bruegel or Diego Rivera, much closer than any other contemporary Japanese painting you've ever seen. And I was compelled to find out more about him. In terms of the oil painters in my film, he's the anchor and the master.
And how does he describe how the events surrounding Anpo affected his art?
From the very first moment I sat down to interview him, he said, you know, it was civil war. After the war, it wasn't peace, it was civil war. We were furiously contesting the outcome of what was going to happen to Japan after the war. And he was part of a very large movement of artists who called themselves reportage painters. It refers to the French and Russian painting movements that intentionally portrayed contemporary phenomenon and contemporary social movements.
Now, you're just back from Japan. I'm wondering now, after this crisis, is there so much of a focus on recovery that this issue is sort of been put aside for the time being, would you say?
Well, yes, I would say that recovery is the huge issue. But in a sense, in a larger sense, of course, the U.S.-Japan relationship still remains contentious, in part because now the nuclear power plants, which if we look back, my film does not touch on this, but there was a program, an Eisenhower program in 1954 called Atoms for Peace. The idea was that if Japan could be persuaded to accept nuclear power plants, the only country in Japan ever to be atomic bombed, then of course nuclear power plants must be safe. That led to now Japan having the second highest number of nuclear power plants next to the United States, and you're now seeing increasing demonstrations in the streets of Tokyo and Kyoto and the major cities of Japan against the continued use of nuclear power.
Linda Hoagland's film is Anpo. For listeners in Boston, it's playing tonight at the Harvard Film Archive. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Linda, thanks very much for being with us.
Deborah, thank you so much.